textural accuracy, and other questions. The sixth talk in a series on the narrative portions of Joshua was presented by David Crabtree on November 27, 2005, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2005. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
The numbers in the Old Testament. I just pointed out in Joshua 8 that we have, in one instance, we have 5,000 soldiers hidden in ambush. And actually, it starts out with 30,000 hidden in ambush, and then later it's 5,000 hidden in ambush. And is there a problem there? Is there a discrepancy there? And in that particular passage, I'm not sure that there's a discrepancy at all. It could be explained more easily. It could be that the 30 are not in ambush. In fact, 30 is the total army. It's only a subset of those 5,000 that were placed in ambush. But I mentioned that numbers in the Old Testament are often problematic. And that there are many who have used the numbers in the Old Testament as an indication that the Old Testament is not reliable. I have a quote from Bishop Colenso. I think he was writing in England. He wrote a book called The Pentateuch and the Book of Joshua Critically Examined. And here's a characterization of this book by Wenham, who I'll talk about in a minute. Quote, he devoted the whole of part one to demonstrating the unhistorical character of the Pentateuch by showing the impossibility of its figures. He realized that on this ground he had an argument which would appeal to the layman, who could not be expected to follow and to weigh the intricacies of the different theories of documentary analysis. He appealed to common sense, and thereby marshaled what was probably the most devastating argument ever leveled against the historical character of the Old Testament. Colenso wrote his preface in 1862, and his argument has never been satisfactorily answered. So the numbers, the discrepancy, the impossibility of some of the numbers in the Old Testament has been used as evidence that the Old Testament is not reliable. And Wenham says that has not ever been satisfactorily countered. So there are many who have dismissed the Old Testament as being historically reliable, but I think that that's premature. I think that's unnecessary, and we'll talk about that. Let me give you an example of why I think that's unnecessary. This is something that I have mentioned other times when I've spoken. So some of you have already heard this, but for others, this may be new. About 100 years ago, one of the major pieces of evidence that was used to as evidence of the unreliability of the Old Testament was the parallel counts in, it would be Kings, and in Chronicles, of the king lists. The king lists both of Judah, the kingdom in the south, and Israel, the kingdom in the north. And there were many places at which they did not reconcile. They weren't in sync. They reported different information as far as how long kings reigned. Primarily it was the number of years that kings reigned. And so that was used as evidence. Well, the Old Testament is full of mistakes and flaws. In the 1950s, there was a man by the name of Edwin Thiel who wrote, he was working on his doctoral dissertation, and he was trying to reconcile the parallel accounts in Kings and in Chronicles. And what he did, his premise was, let's assume that these are correct. Let's assume that these are reliable. How can we find a way to reconcile them? And as he was doing his research, there are three things that he discovered. He was looking at how kings' lists were kept in the surrounding societies, the surrounding cultures. How'd they do it? And there are three observations that he made. The first is that different cultures began the year on a different date. In some cultures, the new year began in April, and in others, I can't remember what the other date is, but there's another month of the year when the new year started. Second observation, that sometimes, and they never record partial years that a king has reigned. So the question is, when the king comes into power, do you count the first part of a year as a year, or do you not count it? And some cultures counted that as a full year, others didn't count that at all. So that's the second thing that was a difference in the way the different cultures kept the king list. And the third one is, what happens when there is a co-reign? When a son becomes a co-ruler along with his father until the father dies, do you count those years in the son's reign, or do you not count them? Some cultures did, some did not. So Edwin Thiel took all of these observations and began to look then at the king's list, and what he discovered is that that both in the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, they developed the habit, the practice of mimicking the culture that they were most closely allied with at the time. If they were allied with Egypt, they would use the Egyptian customs with respect to keeping the king's list. If they were allied with someplace in Mesopotamia, then they would follow the pattern there. If you take that into account, then as you go through the king's list, you can reconcile the accounts in First and Second Kings with those in First and Second Chronicles. So that's what he did. And when that is done, it removes all of the difficulties, except he admits there's one verse that he can't figure out. And as far as I know, that hasn't been resolved yet. But all of the other difficulties disappeared. And to my knowledge, no one has ever raised any issues with respect to the way that he did it. And in fact, that has been adopted in the scholarly, in the academic world as an accurate reconciliation of those two accounts. And that issue has disappeared as an issue that people raise saying that the Old Testament is not reliable. I'm confident that given time, the discrepancies between the numbers, the numbers that are used in the Old Testament, those problems will also be resolved. So I think that we just need to be patient and give the Bible the benefit of the doubt and just wait and see how things shake down. The numbers in the Old Testament are problematic. There are parallel accounts in which a different number is used to describe the same event. For instance, the number of soldiers that die in a battle. In parallel accounts, those are sometimes different. Furthermore, there are instances where a list of numbers is given, and then that list of numbers is totaled. And the numbers that are given don't add up to the total. So there have to be problems somewhere. There are other places where the numbers just seem to be unreasonable. They just cannot be true. So the question is this proof that the Bible was concocted, fabricated? And there are many scholars who argue that the Old Testament was written very late, It was written in the, some would say, the 500 or 600s B.C. So it was written quite late, far after the events that it describes. And it was written for the purpose of defending the power and privileges of the priesthood. And they would see these numbers as just further evidence that, the Bible was written late. Of course, it's full of errors. It was written long after the events that it describes. One of the things that is often pointed to is the numbers that are used to describe the population of Israel, the number of Israelites that left Egypt. In the census figures, in Numbers, we have the list of all of the men of fighting age at about 600,000. If the number of men in fighting age is about 600,000, then the total population has to be three or four times that, if not more. So we're getting into the multiples of millions. And that creates all kinds of difficulties. There was not water enough in the Sinai for that many campers. And how could millions of people be nervous, be afraid to attack Jericho, a city of 3,000-4,000, or Ai, which is a comparable number? They should have had no fear whatsoever. It makes no sense. So those numbers are just preposterously large. Wenham makes a very interesting comment with respect to that. He says, quote, "No one in his senses would, for instance, invent the story of a bus crash in which all 16,000 passengers were killed. The more absurd the figures, the less likely it is that they were invented. Absurdity suggests the likelihood that someone has been trying to transmit records faithfully, in spite of the fact that they do not seem to make sense." I think that's a very good point. That if someone is fabricating a story, they aren't going to come up with numbers that are absolutely absurd. Rather, what is more likely is someone sees something written in the text in front of them, and they, even though they aren't, it looks like it's out of line, they are just trying to record it faithfully. Now, what I was pointing out last week is that numbers are particularly prone to corruption. That if you're copying a text in front of you, and you're trying to copy it carefully and accurately, if a mistake happens, it's more likely to happen and be passed on with respect to numbers than it is with respect to words. And here's what I mean. If I am reading a text and I come across the sentence, "God is Goob," G-O-O-B, I am going to say there's something wrong here. It makes no sense, and I don't know of a word goob. But if in the context "God is good" would fit, I'm going to say there must have been a mistake. A B was substituted for a D. And I can make that correction with a great deal of confidence. You can't just stick any old letter any old place and have it make sense. You can't even just stick any old word in any old place and have it make sense. So with words, they're kind of self-correcting. You can spot an error and you can fix it. You can know with considerable certainty that a mistake was made, and oftentimes you can figure out what it should have been. Let's take an example with numbers, however. Let's say that a sentence says there were 7,531 soldiers killed. And someone mistakes the 7 for a 1, and they write, "There were 1,531 soldiers killed." How would someone coming along ever be able to detect that there was an error there? You can't tell. You could stick any number in any column and it would work. So there's numbers are peculiar in that it very rarely are they in context self-correcting, whereas words are often, are usually self-correcting. Does that make sense? And that was my observation. I told you last week I started collecting these chain letters because I was interested in textual criticism. And these letters, some of them were hand-copied, some were mimeographed, but the mimeographs were really poor quality. Some were photocopied, and you may have forgotten when photocopying first started, they also were very poor quality. And copies of copies and photocopies of mimeographed copies, and it's all kinds of bizarre things happen. And they become quite difficult to read sometimes. And so I was looking at them, and I realized that most of the mistakes were with respect to numbers and names because they are not as self-correcting as words in a sentence. So it shouldn't be surprising that if there are problems in our text, in the Old Testament text, and it's an ancient text, and for a long time, the only way you could get copies was to hand copy those. It shouldn't be surprising that if there are mistakes, they would be most likely to occur in numbers and in names. Wenham points out the kinds of errors that seem to creep in. One kind of error is dropping a zero, so the difference between 700 and 7,000. And he points out that they used to use an abbreviation, which was they would put a number like 7, and then they would put these dashes, just these little lines for each zero after that. And they're just little lines like an apostrophe. Well, you can see how that it would be easy to miss one of those, to misread something like that. Another common error is getting one digit wrong. So 3,000 in one place and 2,000 in a parallel passage, etc. So very, very, the kinds of mistakes that you would expect to happen. But now let's come back to the question of the numbers of the Israelites who were coming through the wilderness and coming into the promised land. Wenham tries to resolve this issue, and he comes up with a proposal that I think is quite interesting. The word for 1,000 in Hebrew is elef. And apparently an elef was not just 1,000, but it was also a fighting unit, like a platoon or, I don't know military terminology, but a division or a company or something. An elef was some kind of unit of a fighting unit. And apparently at one time it was 1,000. But over time, as fighting tactics evolved, the number in an elef changed. The same thing is true of a ma'at, which is the word for 100. That too is a fighting unit, but it's a smaller fighting unit. And at the time of the Exodus, that number was approximately 75. So there were 75 men, fighting men, in a unit that's called 100. In the census, it says there were so many thousand, or so many elephs, and so many hundreds of fighting men. What Wenham hypothesizes is that, and the leader of an elef was an aluf. And that word, when it was written in the consonantal text, so in the oldest texts of Hebrew, they only wrote the consonants. They didn't write the vowels. They weren't there at all. So the difference, when you were looking at it, between the word Eliph meaning a thousand, or this fighting unit, and the leader of one of these units, would have been zero. The difference, there would have been no difference. They would have looked exactly alike. He hypothesizes that an Eliph, then, as we see it in the Old Testament text in Hebrews, is referring to a trained fighter who has special training and is capable of leading a larger unit. So in numbers, then, what we're being told is how many of these special fighters, and then how many of these units of 75 soldiers there are. If you work that through, then, that means that the total number of people that are being accounted for in the census and numbers would be something around 75,000 who would have made the trek across the wilderness and into Canaan. That's a number that's much more in keeping with what you would expect given the context of what's happening in the Exodus and in the conquest. Now, I don't know if that's the right solution or not. It's an interesting proposal. I don't know if that's the right solution or not. Time will tell. I think with time, there will be more evidence, and hopefully this will be cleared up. One of the things that's really interesting about our particular time in history is the extent to which we are developing the tools to be able to reach back and recover history that's been lost. Up until 150 years ago, we as a civilization had lost all knowledge of the civilization of Sumer, which existed in the Mesopotamian region in 3000 BC. We had lost all track of that, all memory of that. And yet through archaeology, we've been able to rediscover a lot of that. We know quite a bit about Sumer. And that's just an amazing development, that ability to reach back and find, rediscover a lost history. 2 or 3 years ago, I became interested in genealogy, and looking at my family history and researching that. And one of the reasons I started to do that is I was thinking, with the death of every person in the family, there is some family history that's lost that's really hard to recover once it's lost. So I've taken on the project of trying to pull together as much as I can. One of the interesting developments in genealogical research is now there are DNA studies. There are DNA studies, mitochondrial DNA studies. Mitochondrial DNA is passed down from mother to child, and it's in an exact replica. And there's a mutation about every 400 years. So you expect it to stay the same for about 400 years, and then you'll have a mutation, a change. So you can figure out how closely related you are to other lines that you're wondering about. Then there's also the possibility to trace the Y chromosome, which is passed from male to male as an exact copy. That's all very interesting, and it's opening up ways of verifying family histories that was not possible before. So there are scientific discoveries that are opening up the past in ways that were unimaginable just a few years ago. And those same kind of developments are happening with respect to archaeology, and as finds are made, and in particular as there are writings that are discovered, ancient writings that are found, it helps us immensely with our understanding of the Hebrew language, the way they did things. And I am still hopeful that in the near future, there will be in some place in Israel a library found. There have been major library findings in virtually every other culture of the ancient world, except in Israel. And we know that Israel was one of the most literate cultures in the area. So I think that it's just a matter of time until such a thing is found. If such a thing is found, that's going to be humongous in opening up our understanding of the Hebrew language and the Hebrew past. So, patience. I think these issues will be resolved. Should the fact that there are problems with respect to the numbers in the Old Testament cause us to be skeptical of the Old Testament text in general? You need to know that the text that we have is not perfect. There are places where we have different texts that have been passed down, say of Isaiah, where one text says one thing at a point and another text says something else. It has a different word there. There are such discrepancies in our text. They are quite few. The Old Testament is a big book, and there are relatively few of those textual variants, but they do exist. There is nothing of major significance. There is no significant doctrine that hangs on the balance of a textual variant. But there are some discrepancies, and the numbers are particularly prone to that. As we look at the differences between the texts, the thing that should strike us is how much is consistent. Those who are copying the texts obviously took great care in copying them precisely. And that is what is overwhelmingly true. But there are some mistakes. I think that we should assume that the text is correct until we have some demonstrated evidence otherwise. Why would God not preserve a perfect text? Why would God allow there to be errors that are in the text at all? Why wouldn't God have preserved the text in its purest form? I don't know the answer to that. But that doesn't seem to be God's pattern. There are a lot of respects in which God has not preserved purity in our lives. That's not his primary emphasis. God seems to like the mundane. The mundane, that's the reality that we know, that's full of problems and full of humanity. And God rarely steps into the main mundane and overrides that. He rarely does that. And that's one of the things that I think is really important to keep in mind with respect to history. There are only a few instances where God has overtly stepped into history and acted directly. The Exodus is one of those times. And he meant to do so. He wanted to step overtly into history. But then he stepped back, and for most of history, he's in the background and lets things happen as they would happen, given the fact that it's human beings that are doing history. And history is full of the flaws of human beings. But God works through the flaws of human beings. I mean, that's the hope of all of us. God has chosen to use us as his instruments to bring about his purposes. He's using us, flaws and all. And I find great comfort in that. That even though God has not perfected me, I am still a suitable instrument for his purposes. And he is capable of working in spite of my flaws to bring about his purposes and do what he wants to do. The text of the Old Testament and the New Testament is substantially what he had the authors write. There are very few errors that have crept in. And he is capable of working through that document, which, because he's chosen to use human beings as his instruments, has flaws in it. He is capable of using that nevertheless. I think it's important to keep in mind that in the Bible, the most important themes are themes that are repeated time after time after time. They are clear. Whatever flaws, few flaws there are in the Bible, they don't interfere with that. We run into the same problem, not just in the purity of the text, but in understanding it. The Bible is a difficult text to understand. And we are human beings, we are flawed creatures who are trying to make sense of it. But God is capable of working through that as well. And he is capable of helping us to see those themes that are there, that are important, and that are repeated. One of the things that has been impressed upon me in the last few years, in particular, is the extent to which I'm convinced that the most important quality for a Bible student is not brilliance, but it's persistence and humility. God has so designed the text that it opens its secrets to those who really want them and who keep coming back. And that the Bible is not primarily information. That's not what it's seeking to convey to us, but it's perspectives. It's an understanding of the world, how it's constructed, what God is up to, and how he's working in our lives. It is a long project to sort all of that out. It's a lifelong project. And the important thing to understand is it's not just us, me as an individual, that I'm left to my own resources to sort that out. But that God is at work in me and working through the Bible, working through my experiences to help me to understand that perspective. So on my end, there are the feeble efforts to come to understand what God is trying to communicate to me. But on the other end, there's God who's reaching out to me and working through his Holy Spirit to communicate to me what he wants to communicate to me. And all of that can be accomplished through any minor errors that there may be in the text. Okay, question number two. Why did God command the Israelites to kill all of the men, women, and children, and animals of the residents of Canaan? I just came up with three reasons. I'll go through these, and then I want to talk a little bit about that practice in general. We know that God was storing up his wrath for the Canaanites because of their wickedness. So it is a punishment for their sin. But the deaths that were commanded, that the Israelites were commanded to carry out, the killings that they were commanded to carry out, those were for the wickedness of the people of Canaan. In general, death is a part of human experience. Death shouldn't shock us. It's an integral part of our lives. God often takes lives, sometimes through natural causes like tsunamis, floods, sometimes through acts of man, war, murders. Sometimes when a life is taken, this is God's response to man's sin. When the Babylonians invaded Judah, that was in response to the sins of Judah. And that was an act of man, a judgment. when fire and brimstone rained down on Sodom and Gomorrah. That was an act of God in judgment. So there are such things that occur in history. But not all deaths are judgment of God. I think of the stoning of Stephen that's recorded in Acts. That is not a judgment on Stephen for his wickedness. In this case, in the case of the conquest of Canaan, this is an act of judgment on the part of God. God had told Abraham in Genesis 15, 13 through 16. Let me read that. This was very early on, after he had given the land, promised to Abraham the land, and then he had entered into a covenant with Abraham. 15:13. He makes this statement. And God said to Abram, "Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. But I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. And as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried at a good old age. Then in the fourth generation they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete." So he's telling Abram that the iniquity of the Amorite, that is the Canaanites living in Canaan, was not yet complete. It would be 400 years until it was complete, at which time then the Israelites would come back. In Leviticus 18:24, talks about this as well. It says, "Do not defile yourselves by any of these things." And these things, in the immediate context, is talking about sexual immorality. "For by all these, the nations which I am casting out before you have become defiled, for the land has become defiled. Therefore, I have visited its punishment upon it, so the land has spewed out its inhabitants. But as for you, you are to keep my statutes and my judgments, and shall not do any of these abominations, neither the native nor the alien who sojourns among you. For the men of the land who have been before you have done all these abominations, and the land has become defiled, so that the land may not spew you out. Should you defile it, as it has spewed out the nation which has been before you," etc. So this is a punishment that's being inflicted upon the residents of Canaan, and the Israelites have been asked to carry this out. The second reason, there are several texts where it indicates that God wanted to eliminate the Canaanites so that there would not be that cultural influence that would have an impact on the Israelites. Deuteronomy 20:16 talks about that. I read this passage last week. It's talking about the rules of warfare that they are supposed to conduct themselves by, and then it talks about specifically in Canaan. In verse 16, "Only in the cities of these peoples that the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, you shall not leave alive anything that breathes, but you shall utterly destroy them, the Hittite and the Amorite, the Canaanite and the Perizzite, the Hivite and the Jebusite, as the Lord your God has commanded you, in order that they may not teach you to do according to all their detestable things, which they have done for their gods, so that you would sin against the Lord your God." That's a theme that is repeated in several passages, that they are to kill all of the Canaanites so that the Israelites will not adopt any of their cultural practices that are abhorrent to God. So God wants to start with a clean slate. He wants to get rid of that cultural influence that was already there. The third reason But God had them kill all of the residents of Canaan. It was, in the time and in the culture, a standard practice. The Israelites are not the only ones who carried out this kind of thing. The Assyrians carried it out. There were other people of the ancient world that carried that out. It is interesting that there are times when God has his people stand against the cultural practices of the surrounding peoples. For instance, they were not to even eat pigs. In Canaan, and certainly in what is now Lebanon, there they sacrificed pigs to their gods. So they were seen as a holy animal, whereas the Hebrews were to see them as an impure animal. So there are times when God asks his people to act contrary to the cultural norms of the time. But there are other times when he asks them to adopt the cultural norms of the time. And then he uses them for his own purposes. And this is one of the instances where he is asking them to do what is culturally standard. But it is interesting that in no case, God's pattern is to always be interacting with the cultural standards of the time to communicate what he wants to communicate. So those are the three reasons. One, a punishment for sin. Secondly, he wants to eliminate the cultural influence. And thirdly, it's the standard practice of the time that God has chosen to adopt. What God had them do was he called the people of Israel harem. And harem means devoted or dedicated. That's a term that's used in the other cultures as well. But they have things that are harem. It's the highest form of something being devoted to, set aside for a special purpose. The word that we have adopted from the Arabic cultures, a sheikh's harem, is derived from this word. It means it's those women who are dedicated or devoted to the head of the household. There are other things that are devoted or dedicated to God, but this is the highest standard. And the thing that seems to make harem distinctive is it could not be revoked. There are other things that were devoted for God's use, but they could be that could be changed through a ritual or whatever. Those things could be redeemed. Those things could be taken out of that devoted purpose. But whatever is harem cannot be taken out of that devoted purpose. And whenever it's used to refer to not just people, but things as well, but whenever it's referred to people, then it indicates death, that it is a person who is declared to be harem must die. It is interesting, this was pointed out in one of the books that I was looking at, it is interesting that the Israelites were instructed to kill every man, woman, and child in Jericho and then set it on fire. By setting it on fire, it takes on a sacrifice kind of similarity. And I'm not sure exactly what to make of that, but I think it's probably significant. Why would God do this? Why would God carry out this kind and request that the Israelites carry out this? That I need to work on some more. It's not clear in my mind exactly how this works. But I'm confident that the Old Testament is full of these pictures that God is developing that are intended to help us to understand spiritual truths. that its concepts are presented in the form of history that then later are developed and take on a fuller significance. And the word that is often used to describe such a thing is a type. And I am confident that the Old Testament is full of types. I'm less confident that I know exactly what a type is. And my suspicion is that there are various types of types. But I think that God has just littered the Old Testament with types. Just a couple of examples. If you'll recall, during the Exodus, they're making their way across the wilderness, and God inflicts upon the people of Israel a plague of serpents who bite people, and they die from the poison of the serpent. And God instructs Moses to make a bronze serpent, put it on a staff, and lift it up. And anyone of the Israelites who is bitten by a serpent and looks at that will be healed, will be saved. Well, I think that has to be a type. That has to be a picture that God has built into history that is designed to help us to understand truths that he's going to go on and present later in more detail. And I think it has to be some picture of, to some extent, Jesus and Jesus' work on the cross. The tricky thing about these types is knowing exactly what the correlation is. How far do you go? What is the nature of the analogy? And that's always tricky. But that there are such things in the Old Testament, I think it has to be true. I mean, it's just full of them. I think that the invasion of Canaan and this ban that has been placed on the Canaanites is similarly a type. Why are they to be completely eliminated? I think because it's a picture of the judgment to come. There is a judgment to come that is more significant than the judgment that the Israelites inflicted on the Canaanites. Because when the Israelites came into Canaan, they just killed them. There's a more significant judgment yet to come. And that is the judgment, the great judgment, when God separates out those who love him from those who hate him. And for those who hate him, there's going to be destruction. And it will be complete, and it will be irrevocable. And I think that this, what God has asked the Israelites to carry out in Canaan, is intended to be a picture of that judgment to come. Okay, the last one, and I'll try to make this quick. I was asked, why would God use the symbol of circumcision? And again, I don't know. It is an odd symbol. We all, I think, would have to acknowledge that. But I think what it is, ultimately, is, and I think that we are intended to reflect on it. It's not an empty symbol. There, we are encouraged to think about why would God choose this particular act to convey what he wants to convey. If you think about it, what it is it's cutting a flap of skin away from a man's penis. And this is analogous, I think, to the removal of the fleshly rebelliousness from our souls. And I think they're plenty of indications in the text, in the Bible, that that's what he intends to convey. Why that particular act? I'll just make several remarks with respect to that particular act. The first is, and this is rather striking, It is for males only. I don't think that we are to conclude from that that the spiritual act that it is analogous to is for males only. But rather, we need to acknowledge that the Bible, and in particular the Old Testament, is, to our sensibilities, unabashedly sexist. The Old Testament law was addressed to men. It was addressed to men. They were to receive it, think about it, assimilate it, make it a part of their thinking, and then teach it to their household. Men were given the responsibility of being the communicators of that truth to their household and take leadership in that respect. And I think similarly, this symbol is a reminder to men of that responsibility that they have. So it is unabashedly sexist in the same way that giving the law is unabashedly sexist. It's not to indicate that the law is not for women or that a transformation of one's soul is not for women, but there is a higher responsibility that is on the shoulders of men with respect to furthering that cause. The second, it is something that is quite mundane, very mundane, that it is by the nature of human anatomy that a man is reminded of his circumcision daily and cannot not be reminded of it daily. And one of the curious things is that it is on an organ that produces pollution daily, uncleanness every day. That's what we are, producers of uncleanness by nature. Third observation, it's intimate. It's not for show. It's covered. That's been culturally the norm in most of the world, that is not, it's not for show, it's not ostentatious. It's between me and God. And I think that's what it's intended to communicate. Fourth observation, it's irreversible, unless they've come up with a circumcision reversal operation, which they probably have. But otherwise, it's irreversible. It's a permanent act. And the fifth observation, I don't remember it, but it had to have been painful. It couldn't have happened without blood, and it had to be painful. And I think that captures something as well about the spiritual reality, that the operation that has to take place for the transformation of our souls is a painful operation, unavoidably so. Okay, that's my best shot at answering those questions, and I've probably raised more questions than I've answered, so I'll give you your chance to comment.
What about the possibility that the circumcision represented a commitment to the next generation or an obligation to the next generation,
mm-hmm.
or even sexual ethics?
You know, that's what's difficult about these symbols, is knowing exactly where to go with them. But it is, on the one hand, it is a very mundane organ, but on the other hand, it is a sexual organ, and that there's got to be some significance there as well, and I think that's true. I appreciate your attempt to answer those difficult questions. I don't know if I would take those on. And I appreciate the observation about types being part of the what's going on with the destruction of every man, woman, and child. I think we forget at times, maybe most of the time, how thoroughly just it is for God to do whatever he wants with his creation. I think in our, especially in our culture, we value life and we put a lot of emotional value in, you know, animals, puppies, you know, butterflies. And in a certain context, that's entirely appropriate. But if God decides to end the existence of any portion of his creation, he certainly has the right to do so at any time that he wants to do that. We don't have the right to take that into our hands, mm-hmm. but God certainly has the right to do that.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I think it's important to keep in mind, however, that God is not capricious. And so he has the right to do whatever he wants, but he is a just God, and he will do things in accordance with that justice. So it would be different if the Canaanites were absolutely innocent, and he tells the Israelites, go in and kill them all. That would be very different from what in fact happened. But what in fact happened is the Canaanites were rebellious against him and his purposes, and that's why he asked the Israelites, go in and kill them all. And an interesting thing is, and I hadn't really reflected on this earlier, but in looking at Joshua now, there is provision for those in Canaan who are not rebellious. So Rahab escapes that judgment. The people of Gideon, the Gideonites, escape that judgment because they're repentant. And that's very interesting. So it's not a blanket destruction of all Canaanites, whether they're rebellious or not. It's a destruction of those who are rebellious.
What I was pointing out helps me accept the reality of that command when it comes to either people that we would consider too young to be of the age where they could be accountable for that kind of thing, or even of the animals.
Right.
How would you reconcile, in the Old Testament when there was judgment, there was a prophecy about that judgment and kind of a warning, kind of saying, if you guys don't repent, then there's going to be judgment, typically. Mm-hmm. In modern day times, we have, you know, tsunamis and people like the Pat Robertsons of the world who say, well, see, that's the judgment of God, and I told you so. How are we to think about that from your perspective?
You mean, are those indeed God's judgment?
Yeah, I mean, because some people would say, well, gee, Pat Robertson is a prophet. Nobody that I know, but some people would say that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So in the ancient times, in the Old Testament times, how was a prophet identified as being authentic? Or was that just simply in retrospect?
I don't know that I know. I don't know that I can answer that. Prophecy, it seems to me that God singled out the Jews for a particular purpose in the world. And the Jews were to be a peculiar people set aside for God's use in communicating his truth to the rest of mankind. So prophets are Jews. I mean, now that's not exclusively the case. If we take Balaam, for instance, Balaam ends up prophesying, but against his will. So it's not that Gentiles can't be used for that purpose, but typically a prophet is a Jew. How do you know when a prophet is a prophet, when someone who claims to be prophesying is a prophet? If their prophecies come true is one of the major indications.
Current day prophets, will put that kind of in quotations, as kind of having prophetic hindsight, kind of like, mm-hmm. I told you so.
Right.
And it seems like in the Old Testament there was kind of often years of prophecy saying, hey, if this doesn't change. And though there's kind of thematically that in some of Christendom, kind of this, you know, if America doesn't repent, then God's going to XYZ. And then when something happens, then it's like, I told you XYZ would happen. Mm-hmm. Is that prophecy? Is that somebody's piety, you know, saying, I'm right and you're wrong? Mm-hmm. I mean, how do we kind of sort that out?
Well, I think if we look at the Old Testament prophets, it seems to me that the pattern is some kind of prediction on the short term that gives credibility to what they have to say that goes beyond that. So that's one thing. And the other thing is a prophet is going to say things that are consistent with what God has said elsewhere. So for our times, I think it's really important that we keep in mind that a prophet has to say things that are consistent with the message of the Bible. But that's, I think we need to use discernment in judging whether a person qualifies as a spokesman for God on the basis of what they both say and do.
I have a question along the same lines as Tim, but maybe from a little different angle. And that is, you kind of made the distinction about some people die because of judgment, some people die just from natural causes. My question is, and in the modern age, we usually, I can't think of a time when we've ever assumed that a death was from judgment. So is that possible, or how would we even determine that a death in modern days, like, you know, in the Bible you have God saying this was from judgment, mm-hmm. but in modern days, like, mm-hmm. how would you even know that?
Well, I don't know that we can know that. I don't think.
Do you think it happens?
I think that God, that there is a sense in which God carries out judgments all the time. That there are individuals who are thoroughly wicked, who die young. I have no problem seeing that as the judgment of God. That there are cultural groups that are afflicted, that are wicked and are afflicted with whatever and die in large numbers, or a geographical area in which there's wickedness and God brings something about where a lot of people die. I think that probably happens frequently. But I don't think that it serves the same purpose as the judgments that we talk about in the Old Testament, because we don't know. God hasn't said, I'm going to judge these people, just watch for their wickedness. It's not that same kind of thing. So does God judge? And there's a sense in which I think that happens all the time on both a micro level and a bigger level. But it doesn't serve the same purpose as what we see in the Old Testament, I think. Just one more and then we got to quit.
I appreciate your presentation today.
Thanks.
I like your list of observations you made concerning circumcision, because it was something I was happened to accidentally study this week. I'd like to make one observation that along, and it's just a little sidebar. Circumcision reminds me of the circle of flesh that's cut away. And that whole symbol of a circle seems to, like the pain that's associated with circumcision. And in a way, I believe it's to, when the Holy Spirit comes into us to give us the gift of faith to believe, that Jesus Christ is our righteousness and that he is the sole person that God the Father made the covenant with when they walked through the two altars that Abraham saw in his dream, mm-hmm. that it reminds us of our own reasoning, how that our own reasoning is circular, and that we cannot use our reasoning to come to God or even to believe in the Scriptures. We believe in it by faith because the Scriptures, are consistent and as they are authoritative by the result that they produce in its fullness in light of the authority of Christ, that they are self-attesting. And there again, we can understand the Scriptures only insofar as they are there, they are readable, they are provable, perhaps historically or by archaeology and so on. For example, the recent finds in Ebla where they found those thousands of tablets that even have the name inscribed on it, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, you know, in archaeology. I happened to get the Archaeological Review. Mm-hmm. And so it's that circle of flesh that's removed so that we can relax and not worry or be dissatisfied with our believing by faith that Jesus Christ is truly the Son of God, equal with the Father, because he himself said so, and the way he used the Old Testament in his own theological presentation to the disciples and others as he was on the mountain. This to me is the beauty of using a symbol like circumcision with Abraham that continues to titillate the mind all of these hundreds of years, mm-hmm. centuries. Mm-hmm.
It is. Those symbols are a curious way of encouraging reflection, trying to figure out why this, of all things? What is God trying to communicate here? It is an interesting way that God has chosen to deal with us. Okay, thanks.